You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everybody.
I don't know if you saw the SNL sketch from this past Saturday of Trump in the transition office talking about his tweets, but there's that one moment where the two government officials, you know, one of them says it's 7 weeks to your inauguration, the other one, he almost has a heart attack. So he said, I never heard somebody put it in terms of weeks before. I feel like that's kind of where I'm at right now. It's still kind of, you know, in the eye of the storm. You can still watch an Obama speech and feel calm for a moment and not remind yourself that, you know, the apocalypse is upon us. I don't know how things are like in a conservative land. I feel there's this dichotomy of people excited about all the things they can repeal and this undercurrent of, wait a second, he's attacking corporations on his tweets and proposing massive, ridiculous tariffs. What have we done to ourselves?
Yeah, a lot of mixed emotions. Some good things could come from this. Some very bad things could come from this. And so that's sort of where we are. I would say, I think, you know, I don't know if your family has anybody like this, but sometimes in families, there is the one person who's like a drama queen who actually likes to sort of stir up trouble and wants drama, like sort of feeds off of drama. And I think Trump is kind of like that. Like, I think he likes to keep things stirred up and interesting. And so I think that's what we're going to have.
I know a lot of folks on the left feel like the Republicans are all going to fall in line. They're all going to salute dear leader Trump and ram all this stuff through, which I totally concede may well happen. But because Trump loves drama and conflict so much, I wonder if he would allow that partisan tranquility to remain if he's just going to want to pick a fight with fellow Republicans, because picking fights is fun and conflict gets you in the news and makes things interesting and that, and he doesn't really care about anything.
I mean, I could see Trump having a Sister Soldier moment on, you know, I just saw today, like, he's going to work something out with the Dreamers, you know,
and
he met with Al Gore and Ivanka wants, you know, climate change to be like part of her agenda. I mean, I could definitely see Trump, and we've always said he's not a conservative. And I mean, you know, you could definitely see Trump sort of having that Sister Soldier moment and attacking conservative, like sort of constitutional conservatives and, you know, triangulating to a certain degree.
Well, he definitely wants to keep everybody off balance. He likes being inscrutable. He likes being unpredictable. He's even said it himself. You know, so I don't look at the Al Gore meeting and say to myself, oh, I guess the climate's going to be okay now. It doesn't ease me in any way, particularly with the type of people that are staffing the transition team. But the Dreamer comment, I do think it does speak to this realization that, you know, hard decisions are going to have to happen soon. You can only dance around these things for so long before, you know, somebody, if you leave the executive order alone, obviously anti-immigration forces aren't going to be quiet about that. And if you do something about it, you got a lot of Dreamers who are going to get sent out of the country, and that's going to create a ton of news coverage, and that's going to set you back on your heels. So you're coming up to the point where the smoke and mirrors is going to be hard to sustain.
Well, the one thing that never made sense to me about Trump is why he would be willing to do and say things that would make him unpopular with, you know, elites. And like when I say elites, I don't mean like Wall Street bankers or think tankers. I mean like Hollywood, people that he seems like he has this need to be liked and to be thought of as like part of the group, part of the crowd. But he did things that would make like Hollywood movie stars disdain him. And I always, like, I was surprised that he would be willing to do and say things that would be so out of step and unpopular with that crowd. And I think that it's that he may try to repair that in the way that he governs, and that he could, you know, be thinking like, how can I be perceived as a good guy that these important people like? And, you know, it's ironic because, we think of Trump as being so kind of like conservative, but he's really not. I mean, he's extreme in a different way, but not ideologically. But I would not be surprised if he does end up getting into picking and choosing fights with like the Freedom Caucus wing, and he'll be on the side that's the more popular side with the American public.
I'm gonna ambush you with our first 2020 question, which I know our commenters despise when we start playing pundit politics so far out.
2020. So this is a Hugh Downs, Barbara Walters trivia question, I assume.
That's right. What are the odds Trump has a Republican primary challenger?
Oh, I think that I think they're pretty good. I think better than 50%. The question I think is it somebody that is it a serious challenge? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I think that like could like a Justin Amash or from sort of the libertarian. Or an Evan McMullen.
McMullen's out there. McMullen is definitely keeping his profile up the best he can and indicating he is the beacon of the conservative resistance.
Right. Or will it be Ted Cruz or Rand Paul or someone like that? I think that I would probably give it better than 50%, that there's some sort of a primary challenge. And the real question is it a serious challenge?
All right. So to one other thing that is potentially dividing the caucus is Obamacare. We're seeing stories that the caucus is not unified on when to force the repeal and what to replace it with. And so the imminent question is, because they don't have the replacement in place, the going thinking is, well, we'll do a quickie repeal bill that has a 3-year time frame and give us time to work out what the replacement is. And you got the Freedom Caucus guys saying, whoa, you can't put this into the next Congress. That's a joke. You got to repeal this thing now. I mean, and maybe they're saying, 2 years is kind of the upper bound of what they'll allow, but it's got to be sort of within this Congress. I mean, this sort of relates to the Dreamer question. At some point, you got to do it. Or if you don't actually do it, you piss off your hardcore base. If we actually do it, you risk taking away health insurance from people, and that could present its own political problems. I mean, do you think that the Republicans have really come to grips with, how much they're biting off here?
No, I don't think there's a full appreciation of how dangerous this is. I think you're right. I mean, the beauty of the Obamacare thing has always been that Obama owned it. And so anything that went wrong with Obamacare or healthcare in general was sort of blamed on him. And now Republicans are going to own it. And I don't think it's possible to please sort of principled, philosophical conservatives and also do something that is popular with the American public. So I think those
I always thought that was the key thing of Obamacare, that people were always mad or befuddled. Why did Obama embrace the individual mandate? He knew in the primaries of 2008 that was not a popular approach. That there was something that had a feeling of coercion. You're making somebody buy something they don't necessarily want to buy. Why didn't he do single payer? Why didn't he do public option? All that kind of stuff. I always felt that just by doing it at all, no matter how imperfect that it is, you bake in the cake that this is now a public responsibility. It's a responsibility of the federal government. If something goes wrong, you say, well, it's on Obama's head, and now it's on the Republican's head. Well, that means it's on the U.S. government's head whenever something goes wrong. And that is a very, very hard thing to undo. You've now created an expectation that this is something that the government takes care of. And if something goes wrong, you have to go fix it.
Which is part of the reason why Obamacare was such a problematic thing if you're a conservative. And there's always a sense that once people get used to an entitlement, you can't roll it back. You can reform it, but you're right. I mean, there's been a paradigm shift, and now there's an expectation that this is a proper role of government. That toothpaste doesn't go back in the tube so easily.
Right. So you had a column this week, and one of the other things that Trump did that caused a lot of agita and hyperventilation was the phone call that he had with the president of Taiwan that violated longstanding foreign policy, the one China policy that we don't acknowledge or recognize Taiwan as an independent state. We do other things with Taiwan that make China unhappy with us. We sell them arms, for example, but we've drawn the line at actually calling them the president of Taiwan, and Trump violated that by taking the phone call and announcing the phone call using that kind of language. You argue in your roll call column — this is roll call, right, not a daily caller?
Yeah, roll call. Yeah.
You argue that, you know, that Trump was onto something here.
Well, so let me first put it into context. Just like everybody else, I'm sort of grappling with my role in the world and my value added, like in this post, in this new Trump, brave Trump world. What I'm trying to do is to really be intellectually honest and hold Trump accountable when I think he's wrong, and raise red flags when I think he's wrong, but also be fair to him in a way that I think some liberals probably are not willing to be. So I think, to me, some liberals and some on the left are attacking Trump, but they would be attacking Marco Rubio. Like, so it's not that there's nothing — a lot of their criticism isn't anything that's unique to Trump, that Trump's uniquely bad. It's just that they just don't like conservatism, right? And so I'm trying to walk that line and to balance it. And I had written a piece at the Daily Caller titled something like, "Should We Be Afraid of Donald Trump?" And I was pointing out my concerns about his authoritarian strongman tendencies, and my concerns that, God forbid, if there was some sort of a major terrorist attack, how would he respond to that? And I have concerns about that. This is in the context of sort of balancing that out. I had raised concerns about him. I mean, other people have compared him to Hitler. So I thought, well, that's interesting. And I think that's fair, I don't think that, anybody's going to compare him in terms of like that he's going to start a Holocaust or something. But, we should be learning from history. And I don't like there's like the Godwin's law or whatever. But I don't like sort of putting intellectual restraints on people and saying, well, you can't ever use this. You can't learn from history. You can't compare anyone to this, to what happened. The way this guy that everybody thought was a clown in Germany managed to sort of roll over the establishment elites one by one. So, but I think if it's fair to sort of wring our hands and worry about the kind of the worst possible comparisons, then let's also make some positive comparisons. And it really struck me that this Taiwan call reminded me a lot of Reagan. Not specifically how Reagan dealt with Taiwan or with China, but how he dealt with the Soviet Union. And what I'm getting here is that that Reagan really sort of flouted conventional wisdom. He did things that were potentially dangerous, like joking about we're going to bomb Russia in 5 minutes. provocative, such as Donald Trump's tweets, one might say.
Evil empire.
The evil empire. And by the way, I don't know if you've gotten into the Americans, but there's a great montage scene at the end of, I think it's season three, maybe it's four, but it's the last episode in one of the seasons where Reagan is giving the evil empire speech and they're juxtaposing the reactions of the Americans. And clearly they're very afraid of this moral clarity that he's bringing up. And in a way they think he might be a madman, you know, which, by the way, I think Trump has going for him too, is the unpredictability. And is this guy crazy? I think Reagan so far has come out looking really good in the Americans by sort of scaring them and keeping them on guard. The other thing too is Mr. Gorbachev tear down this wall. As you know, the State Department deleted that or drew a line through it multiple times and tried to expurgate. They tried to take out that line. And so this is sort of the so-called foreign policy establishment experts didn't like it. Reagan also went against the sort of realpolitik realist Henry Kissinger school that had been accepted, and then whether it's Nixon or Ford and detente and like all those policies that the so-called experts believed in, Reagan went against them. So I just thought this was a good opportunity. Because I like to sort of check myself, I think it's a possibility that I look back a few years from now and say, man, I should have been harder on Trump because damn, he turned out to be really dangerous. And I wish I'd been a little harder on him. And I think I've been pretty hard on him, but I also think there's a chance that I'll look back in 10 years and be like, Donald Trump ended up being a great president, and he basically became the new Ronald Reagan. And now I look like George Will, who famously, you know, accused Reagan of sort of selling out, I guess it was at Reykjavik or whatever.
He dumped on Reagan at the very end of the administration, and said that he abandoned conservative principles way out the door.
So look, I don't do things or write things or say things based on like how am I on the right side of history? You know, that's more of an Obama thing anyway, being on the right side of history. But it is something to think about, and so I try to be fair, and I think that there's like a group think in D.C. and a conventional wisdom that says Trump is going to be a bad president, and he's defied people all along. I don't know how this is going to shake out. I'm going to try to really be fair and call him like I see him. And I think this Taiwan thing, actually, I was kind of pleasantly surprised. I don't think there was as much hand-wringing or pearl-clutching as I thought there might be. In fact, I think a lot of people actually kind of came down on my side of this, that he broke with protocol, but maybe that needs to be done sometimes.
Well, you also have this former CIA official on CNN yesterday calling their whole foreign policy apparatus clown show. So I think there's a fair amount of pearl clutching in certain quarters. But I think Reagan is a very important touchstone here. I think there are a lot of parallels. Although Reagan had more government experience coming into this, but he had a similar aversion to the hard facts, a desire to not worry about fact checking everything. He was not a big micromanager. Did not sweat details. Wanted to delegate a lot of stuff to staff, and that caused a lot of problems for him at a lot of points in his administration. I can certainly see Trump acting in a similar way. You know, Reagan was not a big briefing books guy, and Trump's not a big briefing books guy. And as Reagan broke norms and caused the left a lot of anxiety, so will Trump. I don't accept the pat conservative narrative of the clear-eyed Reagan staring down the Soviets and crushing them and ending the Cold War. But unlike a lot on the left, I do acknowledge, in fact, I think it's very important history, that there was a bona fide Reagan pivot with Gorbachev post Reykjavik. And Reykjavik was part of it. I mean, Reykjavik is sort of the conservative narrative. Reykjavik is, you know, Reagan stormed out when Gorbachev wouldn't let Reagan keep Star Wars, and that showed them who's who and what's what. And the Soviets fell apart after that. And I don't think that's accurate. What happened to Reykjavik was that Reagan actually blurted out that he was willing to abandon nuclear weapons altogether. And while he didn't budge on Star Wars at that moment or at all, that made Gorbachev realize that there was an opening here. And when Gorbachev's people told him afterwards, you know what, Star Wars is never going to happen, so just don't sweat it. Gorbachev then went back to Reagan with a more modest proposal in reduction of nuclear arms, the INF Treaty, which Reagan embraced and had to push off on the right to get that passed. The right wing thought he had gone soft on the Soviets at that point. And Reagan overtly said, look, the people who are opposed to this think that war is inevitable and peace is not possible, and I don't. People can do unexpected things. And there's definitely, as horrified as I am by Trump and disgusted as I am with how he came into office, I can't totally discount the possibility that he's going to do a similar kind of pivot like that, because I think he totally lacks any kind of core convictions, and so he can pivot any way at any time.
I've always thought that the spectrum, the potential range of Trump is huge, and I just felt like America is too precious to take the chance on the downside was so great that it's not a, you know, I've got a lot to lose. Now I think a lot of other Americans didn't have a lot to lose, and they're like, what I got nothing to lose. I'm willing to take that gamble. But I've always thought that the potential upside was really big. I mean, Trump could, I mean, I think there's a chance Trump gets impeached. I think there's a chance that Trump gets us involved in some major international crisis. I think there's some chance that Trump, like, uses some horrible event to try to, like, seize power. You know what I mean? But I think there's also a chance that Trump will be considered a great president, and that he will be a redefined things and co-opt some issues that that Democrats thought they owned, and be like a transcendent sort of an era, the beginning of an era of Trump. I mean, I think Trump could go down as a great president. That's within the realm of possibility.
Well, to talk more about the glass half empty possibilities, I had a piece in Real Clear Politics this week called "Is Democracy Doomed? We've Been Here Before," and you were alluding to the various Hitler parallels and 1930s parallels that many people are making with a lot of strong historical justification. Not that Trump is going to exterminate the Jews, but their rises to power have similarities. And so there are these two researchers. I'm now going to forget their names. Like one's last name is Yaunk, and the other one is Fao. And they put forth a new study showing. Well, first they argue that there is a early warning system where democracies can backslide. And you know, so people shouldn't assume that once you go democratic, you can't go back. You can go back, and it's happening in Venezuela. It's happening in Poland.
This is the study that showed that an increasing number of Americans would be okay with military rule.
Right, that's exactly right. So what they say is there's a three-pronged early warning system: a decrease in belief that living in a democracy is essential. An increase in support for or being open to non-democratic rule, and the rise of a party or a movement that is premised upon the current system being illegitimate. And so, you know, Trump ran on a platform that everything is rigged, trust nothing, you know, this whole system is rotten. There are surveys taken that ask you to rank from 1 to 10, how essential is it to live in a democracy? And generationally, this is true not just in the U.S., but They also looked at New Zealand and Sweden and I think Great Britain and a couple others where the patterns are very similar. If you're older, you're much more inclined to give a 10 to it's essential to live in a democracy. And if you're younger, that number is literally around 30%. That you're giving a 10 ranking. Now, some people say these guys are over-hyping the results because these folks are still saying, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9. But the researcher point is if you're not at 10... There's a softening there that leaves you open to being rolled.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote a piece. I don't know if you remember this, but I wrote a piece like maybe 4 years ago about the rise of monarchism on the right.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like something I was picking up on. I was at the Week. It was at the Week, and it was about this increase. Like, and I didn't realize it at the time, but it was definitely tapping into some of the stuff that's going on in the alt-right. I remember Jonah Goldberg, who I think's a really interesting and very good writer, like kind of mocked that piece. and I wonder
well,
how
well, now you have.
Today.
And so that's the research also showed that whereas 1 in 16 before were okay with a military coup if the government was failing, now that number's 1 in 6. So there's a shift there too. So they're saying that those are the warning lights from their perspective, and my point was, you know, in the 1930s there was a sense in America and elsewhere that democracy didn't work. We were still in the middle of the Great Depression.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again: democracy simply just does not work. Wasn't that from The Simpsons?
Right. So, you know, there lots of folks said that at the time. There were over 100 outright fascist organizations in America. There was an alt-right of the time. There was a publication called American Review, which was openly pro-fascist. They call themselves the home for radicals of the right, just like Breitbart was termed the platform of the alt-right. And as much as there was, you know, sympathies for Hitler and Mussolini, now you have sympathies for Putin, who is very much, you know, he's not a communist dictator. He's much more like a fascist than anything else. So you have the, and also, it's not just the purview of the right. You had in the 30s Huey Long, who, as several historians have noted, was the closest thing that America has had to a totalitarian executive in our history. He ran Louisiana like a dictatorship. He took over every facet of government, from the judiciary branch to the hiring of public school teachers. He literally military occupied New Orleans when the mayor was resisting his political moves, and declared partial martial law in New Orleans. And he was gearing up for presidential run in 1936, and we don't know if he could have won or if he could have derailed FDR's reelection because he got assassinated in 1935. That's the only thing that stopped that guy from running. So we've had the ingredients of this before, but of course we didn't tip over in the 30s. We galvanized by Pearl Harbor, and we were resolute against. Eventually, resolution against fascism, and it all worked out in the end. So I don't want to. I think there's lots of things today that are not like the 30s. We're not in a Great Depression, for one thing, and we don't know exactly which direction Trump is going to go once he is in office. So I think on one hand, you don't want to act like we are this close to becoming fascist. But on the other hand, you want to say, you know what, you know, democracy is not that sturdy all the time. And so if you are concerned, you want to remain vigilant. And so when Trump does things that are anti-democratic, you want to be right in his face about it.
But this is where I think you and I'm surprised to hear you say this, because I think I've always worried more about the fragility and vulnerability of what we have here in this country. And you've always believed that America was just utterly resilient and that worries were just overwrought.
My optimism has taken a bit of a bruising in the past few weeks. And again, I don't want to be overly hysterical and glom onto every possible worst case scenario, because I don't think that's helpful either. And I think there's a lot of danger in that, where I see people assuming all these horrible things Trump is going to do, and if you treat that as a given, and then he falls short of that worst case scenario, you're just helping him do other awful things. Yeah. So I don't want to set low bars for him to clear.
Yeah. Or you just go crazy, you know? This is a time for us to be very intentional and to kind of recalibrate, you know, our role and what we do and how we view this. But I think that what we have is so precious, we have to be very vigilant without being paranoid and crazy, you know.
And it's not just here, of course. I mean, you're seeing this throughout Europe also, where, Italy is now in disarray, which is not that unusual for Italy, but, the five-star movement might be ascendant there, which is not as right-wing a populist movement as other countries, but still, it's still anti-EU. I mean, that's sort of the big question. Is the EU going to collapse? If you have populist right-wing movements win in Germany and in France and Italy, on top of what's happened in Great Britain already, does the EU fall apart? If the EU falls apart, and Trump recedes from the global stage, and Russia is ascendant, and China is ascendant, are you creating a new world order where basic tenets of democracy and human rights are greatly diminished? I mean, that to me is the biggest worry right now. Not so much that Trump's going to lead us all into the gas chamber, but there's going to be a general backsliding of the international standards that we've worked several decades to achieve.
And that's the interesting thing is how so much of this is tied to World War II. I mean, I don't think it's overstating it to say that like what we're experiencing right now is basically a rejection of everything that we learned after World War II. I mean, whether it's isolationism or whether it's sort of the way that we view protectionism, or whether it is the rise of the alt-right. Now, look, we've had white supremacists and neo-Nazis all along. I remember in the 80s, we had them. But they're back in a way that I don't think they had been back in since what you were describing a few minutes ago here in America, where you had sort of like openly fascist people. And I think it was mainstreamed in a way that like in the 80s, if you were like a neo-Nazi or a Klansman, you were very isolated by society and you were sort of it was not cool. And I do worry that it's becoming like more accepted and mainstreamed.
Well, and that's obviously the concern, and that's why this whole movement of trying to not normalize things is cropping up. Although Matt Iglesias had a post at Vox saying you want to normalize Trump. If you normalize him, you rob him of his populist power. When he's breaking norms, that's what feeds him. So, but I don't think you want to be sanguine when anti-democratic things happen. You don't want to look away from these hipster profiles of alt-right leaders. You want to make very clear that this is not what America is supposed to stand for. I certainly can't make any optimistic predictions that it's all going to be okay at this point. But I think we do have history at our disposal. It's one thing the folks didn't have in the 30s. We have the 30s to remind us to never forget and to say, there are things that there are lines that we shouldn't be crossing here.
Indeed. Wow. Heavy topic today there, Bill Scherr.
I'm sorry to be a buzzkill. And that's why you don't come to us looking for me to be Debbie Downer.
You're bringing me down, man. I'm going to send you some Xanax or something.
I'll perk you up by saying you should read the David Letterman interview of Tina Fey in Hollywood Reporter. That was good stuff.
Cool. I think that people should get my Too Dumb to Fail book, the paperback.
Well, it's a great stocking stuffer.
$12 on Amazon Prime right now. Maybe it's $12.38. And the paperback is it literally could fit into a stocking. It's a smaller somehow. Don't ask me how, the magic of publishing. This would be a stocking stuffer.
Another great stocking stuffer is the classic tome, Wait to Move to Canada, by Bill Scherer, written in the dark days after Bush's reelection.
Yeah.
That, I think, is probably 2 cents on Amazon in paperback right now. You could pay full price for the relevant Kindle version. I get more royalties for that. But either way, a perfectly wonderful holiday. I'm told that I have to say Merry Christmas now because of Trump.
Yes, the law.
Hanukkah and Kwanzaa no longer exist, so Merry Christmas to you, Matt.
Merry Christmas, and belatedly, happy St. Nicholas Day.
No, you're not allowed to say that.
Yesterday.
You have to say Nicholas. Merry Christmas. There's no other thing to say you're in Trump's America.
That too. I'll recommend the VeggieTales St. Nicholas episode if you'd like to introduce your children to the story, the legend, and the true story of St. Nicholas. Whether you're a Kris Kringle family or a St. Nicholas family, I think you should, if you've got little kids, check that out. And check us out, you know. Pay it forward. Tell a friend. Turn them on to this show.
I suppose you could probably rate us on iTunes. People say that's important, to do iTunes ratings. I'm sure there's a podcast page there that's worth checking out.
You got it. All right. So until next time, Bill, always a pleasure talking.
Same here. Till next
Merry week. Christmas. Merry Christmas. God bless. And we'll see you next week here on the DMZ.
Take care.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.